This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, listeners. Welcome back to the New Books Network. I am Agathe Guy, host of the channel. Today we will be talking with Regine Spector about her book, Order at the Bazaar, Power and Trade in Central Asia, published in 2017 by Cornell University Press. Regine is an associate professor in the Department of Political Science at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. She teaches comparative economic, development, energy, and Central Asian politics. Her current research examines New England energy politics and electric grid reform and the climate implication of our energy and water use practices. Regine, thanks a lot for being here with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, that's really a pleasure. And to start us off with our discussion today with your book, I really wanted to ask you about your motivation for researching this really specific topic.
Yeah, thank you. I came at this through a confluence of a number of different interests and life experiences. I've always been interested in everyday life and how people make meaning in whatever contexts they find themselves in. My first travels to the post-Soviet region more generally were in the late 1990s in Russia and then in Tbilisi, Georgia, where I witnessed firsthand the implications of the collapse of the Soviet Union and the radical changes facing people in society. After that, I worked at think tanks in Washington, D.C., including doing some research on Central Asia. And I really was inspired to go back to graduate school at that time to better understand what was happening specifically in Central Asia through the lens of people living in the region and not through Moscow or Russia-centric perspectives, which dominated a lot of the literature in the 1990s. So in graduate school, I thought a lot about authoritarianism and the resource curse and political economy in my classes. But I became really motivated, especially on my first trip to Tashkent in the summer of 2003, to investigate the shuttle trade and traders and bazaars, because everyone around me seemed to either be trading or have a relative who was trading. And the conversations on the ground really inspired me to make this the focus of study. Unfortunately, due to events in the summer of 2005 in Uzbekistan and Andijan, I pivoted at that time to focus more on bazaars and trade in Kyrgyzstan and Kazakhstan, due to the closing of political space and challenges with opportunities for research in Uzbekistan that emerged during the time that my field research was ongoing.
I see that's really interesting. And there's something that come to my mind whenever you spoke. Could you a little bit explain to our listeners the specificity of bazaar in Central Asia?
Absolutely, yes. So bazaars, as we all know, exist in many different places and contexts and cultures around the world. In Central Asia specifically, they have both, I would say, a material and physical feel, as well as a particular set of understandings. Just to give the listeners a bit of a perspective, the bazaars I'm talking about and the ones I'm researching are both wholesale and retail bazaars. Especially the wholesale bazaars became huge commercial hubs in the 1990s and 2000s, huge source of employment, the main source of commodities that people would buy and sell. And to give you a sense of the height of the trade, just the containers alone, you know, there were shipping containers that were brought into many of the wholesale bazaars. They became both the storage units for goods as well as the storefronts by day. They were selling for as much as $100,000 or $200,000 during the height of the trade, as much as apartments in downtown Bishkek, which signifies how desirable they were, especially in certain parts of this bazaar that had significant trade turnover. But going back to your question about what's specific about bazaars in the post-Soviet space more specifically, I think that one thing I noticed, especially in Kyrgyzstan and Kazakhstan to some extent, is that while there was a history of farmers markets in the Soviet period, for example, bazaars, there were some new bazaars that started in the 1990s, but some of them were either kolkhozny rynki, farmers markets, or flea markets during the Soviet period that became privatized essentially upon the Soviet Union's collapse. So while indeed sidewalks alongside the bazaars may be public spaces, many of the pavilions and trading rows and sections of the bazaars became privatized. And so in other parts of the world, you might see debates about public space and the right of traders in public or municipal spaces. You see this a little bit less in the post-Soviet context, I think, because of the nature of these privatized land and working spaces. I also think you see some differences in understandings of those who ended up working in the bazaars. I think in Central Asia, you have a particularly complex history and layered understanding of what bazaars mean to different groups. Whether it's ethnicities or citizens of these regions historically. You have histories of nomadic versus sedentary lifestyles and traditions, and they've played out differently in the bazaars at different time periods over the centuries and millennia. You also have understandings that were imbued during the Soviet period around what it means to trade and what it means to work in bazaars or marketplaces. And in particular, as I discuss a little bit later in the book, there were many people from all different ethnic groups who found bazaar trade to actually be very shameful in light of Soviet understandings of reselling goods and speculation that became a predominant mode of thinking during the Soviet era. So I think those types of particularities, both in terms of property and governance, as well as understandings around work and trade and markets, have their own specificities within the post-Soviet and specifically Central Asian context.
Thanks a lot for this really complete answer. And I was also wondering, usually, historically, when we speak and when we think about bazaar in Central Asia, we mainly think about Uzbekistan, which is also maybe why you started there. And I was wondering, because now, whenever you go to Bishkek, so the capital city of Kyrgyzstan, the main Dordoy Bazaar, which is a bazaar a little bit at the north, let's say, of the city, is considered in Central Asia as one of the main bazaar, if not the biggest one of all Central Asia. Could you explain how is it possible? Why in Kyrgyzstan especially?
Yeah, thank you. That's a great question. I think Kyrgyzstan had a very, very particular confluence of both liberalization policies as well as specific initiatives of certain individuals that led it to be home to one of the biggest bazaars in Central Asia. I think in particular, Kyrgyzstan, as opposed to neighboring countries such as Uzbekistan or Turkmenistan, liberalized its economy very rapidly under the first president, Askar Akayev. And by that, I mean opened up the doors for movements of people and goods. Now, Kazakhstan did that to some extent too. So just as a footnote, in Almaty, there's a very large bazaar there, Baraholka, which also became a huge wholesale bazaar in Kazakhstan. But these two countries, I would say primarily in Kyrgyzstan in particular, had favorable policies that allowed for movements of goods and people. And then you combine that with a certain very particular history of Dordoy as a flea market that did exist by the end of the Soviet period and that had a certain space and place and understanding around the role that place could play. And in a certain sense, when the Soviet Union collapsed, you had increasing numbers of traders who would sell the goods that they had at the bazaar and increasingly start to bring goods from China or from other parts of the world over. And the bazaar grew from people selling out of their trunks to very elaborate rows and systems of aisles and services, both physical and financial, including money exchanges and cafes. And that particular history, I think, is one that I talk a little bit about in the section on Dordoy Bazaar in the book.
Thank you. That was really interesting. And so I have the impression that there is a really specific relationship between the state and the bazaar and the way the state is involved or not, involved in its own way in the bazaar. Could you explain us a little bit about that?
Absolutely, yeah. I think here I had a particular set of understandings around the state, especially from afar and from reading some of the literature on and even experiencing what I experienced, for example, in the aftermath of the 2005 overthrow of Askar Akayev. I think that the state is often perceived in the region as weak or as corrupt or as chaotic, especially in the context of the overthrow of Akayev and even under President Korman Mekbakiyev between 2005 and 2010 when I was primarily conducting this research. And so the perception was that the state, while on the one hand it liberalized and opened doors for trade and movements of good and people, on the other hand was somewhat chaotic and predatory from the perspective of bureaucrats and bribes and lawlessness. And I think that was the context that increasingly became encapsulated in governance indicators, rule of law indicators, for example. And what really struck me as I started to talk to everyday people and my friends and the networks that I had on the ground, that the situation was more complicated and that there were these understandings of a certain order, which is how I come to the title of the book and the overarching framework, Order at the Bazaar, which was that people were thinking about not only the disorder and the chaos and the violence, the lawlessness, but they were thinking about how to make their context and their work environment more livable, that they had certain rights, that there were processes that could lead to either respect or cleanliness or peace or a certain set of responsibilities. And it was all of these different understandings of order that I figured out people were referring to, right? In different, depending on who I was talking to, people invoked different understandings of order and different contexts for which order was meaningful to them. That's how I arrived at the overarching framework for the book. And I think it serves as kind of a way to think about how order in these local pockets or islands can exist within these broader states or state structures that are perceived to be either disorderly or chaotic or lawless. And I think that's kind of how I saw the tension as it manifested in my own field research. And I tried to unpack that in different specific contexts and bazaars throughout.
And speaking about order, like, how did you come up with this term? Is it part of an existing literature that you build your research around? Or, I mean, could you describe what you mean by order?
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's in the social sciences more generally, this question of political order or social order, I think, is well established, whether it's going back to Huntington's political order and changing societies, or back to core theorists such as Weber or Smith, even, right, who are thinking about order, social, political, economic order. I think for me, there was an emergent body of literature on Central Asian societies and politics, including people who were looking at political order in terms of authoritarian regimes or economic micro orders, for example, Rano Toraeva's work on this. And I started to think about order through the lens of both these broader theories and the literature, but really very much from the perspective of the conversations and even the documents in the newspapers I was reading. So, for example, there were newspapers, I started to do this research in the libraries and found newspapers where the headline was Pariyarak na Bazar, right? Or Bardak, right? These terms that describe order and disorder. And I realized that this was a core overarching discourse and framework in a certain sense for everyday people. And I think that's really what brought me to the concept. And I would say Fred Schaeffer's, you know, elucidating social science concepts and this idea of immersing yourself in a local context and understanding what a particular concept means to everyday people was a guiding tenet of the book. So he does this with concepts such as democracy, which we know have many different meanings depending on the culture and the context and even the group of people that you're talking with. And so I thought if we take a concept like order and do a similar kind of, in a certain sense, unearthing or excavation, then that would help us shed light on broader state-society relations and transformations of political economy and society in this context.
I see. And before you also spoke about different understanding of the bazaar, especially depending on the ethnicity, depending on the background, I guess age also. Is there similar processes, patterns with order?
Yes. So I think depending on who you talk to, right, you get different understandings of what order means. So for example, if we take Dordoy as an example of a bazaar, I was very attuned to talking to different people at Dordoy. So not only traders and subsets of traders, for example, some of the elders who took on responsibility within this trade union at the bazaar, but also the owners. And while I didn't actually interview the owners of Dordoi, there were significant press interviews with the owner. So I used many of these interviews in the local press, both in Russian and in Kyrgyz, as a foundation to understand how he talked about his role. And here, I think for him, order was very much a kind of political economic order. That is, an understanding that it was his role to kind of create almost a stability, a political cover to allow infrastructure, roads, electricity to be built to service the burgeoning trade. And for him to create the political connections, including through his member of parliament status, to be able to provide that. And I think over time, over the last few years, we've had a number of other really interesting examples of this type of patron in society in Kyrgyzstan specifically, whether it's, you know, Aksana Ismailbekova's work on Rahim and Blood Tides in the Native Son, or Morgan Liu's work on a patron in the south of Kyrgyzstan, Batyrev. They played these roles to create a certain type of order and stability from there and of their lens or their worldview, right? And yes, while it enabled a certain kind of elite and rentier class, you could argue, and this is the perspective of Bahar Sangria and Almira Satapaldieva, right? That there are these huge inequalities and kind of rentier classes in the region. It also provided a certain order, I would argue, and political stability that allowed this bazaar to continue to prosper. And but then when you think about order from the perspective of, say, the traders in the bazaar, or those who are working within this context, we saw and had many examples of different types of disorder that they experienced, right? Whether it was the bureaucrats who initially were coming to take bribes all the time, and in other parts of the city, in the stores, you know, there was a store that I observed one time that would sell drinks in the center of the city. And I stayed and I witnessed like five or seven different bureaucrats who would come in and kind of take their share. And I did not see that at Dordoi Bazaar. And I think it was precisely this understanding that they had, the traders and then this trade union had created, that allowed for less predation from bureaucrats in terms of everyday trader experiences, which was an important understanding of order for the traders. And that in addition, they created other understandings of what an honorable workplace would be, or one that supported the traders. For example, certain trust between the traders and the rows, different forms of mutual aid that they would provide for each other. For example, if a trader was in a difficult situation, they would come together and celebrate certain holidays or meals together. And these forms of order varied, but took real form, I think, depending on the context and the situation. So those are just a couple of examples from Dordoi specifically.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud. Or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda. Whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Thanks a lot for that. I think it's going to give our listeners more understanding of what we exactly mean. And I was wondering, as you were living in Kyrgyzstan, did you see those concept of orders spreading among society outside of the workers at the bazaar?
Yes, very interesting. Well, the first thing I'll note is that this was not just the case at Dordoy Bazaar. I know I gave some examples from Dordoy, but in my other experiences at bazaars, such as Osh Bazaar, which is also a big bazaar, but it's in the center of the city and it's considered more of a retail bazaar for produce and commodities, although it serves as a regional wholesale bazaar for people in the nearby villages. You had different forms of this type of order. I think the contrast with that bazaar is really important because it shows that not all bazaars had the same ownership and governance structure. And because of its own particular history of existing during the Soviet period and then being privatized, and I learned this through very elaborate newspaper articles at the time that kind of detailed some of the contestations around these privatizations and ambiguities. You had other forms of authority and ways of thinking about order emerge. And I think this is interesting because at Dordoy, I didn't hear very much about, for example, aksakals or other elder forms of authority, but that existed in an Osh Bazaar, at least in certain pockets or people who self-identified as such, even though it was interesting, some of the people in their 50s, some of the men, for example, said, well, I'm not a real aksakal if you were to go to a village. But within the context of this bazaar, they narrated their role as resolving conflicts or understanding, seeking to forge understanding among traders or between traders and customers. So I think society in Kyrgyzstan is highly diverse and very and increasingly shifting and changing, and looking for these pockets of order is really fruitful. And so, to answer your question about looking outside of the bazaar, I definitely found that in other contexts. For example, in the period of the mid 2000s when I was in Bishkek, I heard and learned of this apparel industry that was burgeoning in many basements and underground. And this was another space that I started to think about how a certain order was created, or how at this time apparel producers or sewers or shop owners were dealing with similar challenges, right? Whether it's bureaucratic predation or the provision of electricity or challenges with supplies or with workers and sewers. And I think that in this context, which I'd be happy to speak a little bit more about, there were similar types of contestations and efforts to create these pockets where, again, in what was perceived as a country that had a dramatic manufacturing collapse after the Soviet Union collapsed, right? You had huge manufacturing facilities that produced fabrics and yarns, and they looked dead from the outside, right? Those buildings and the supply chains crumbled. But within those buildings and in basements throughout Bishkek, you had a reconstitution of shop owners and producers who had small scale operations. And it was, again, this perspective that we need to talk with them and think about how they're addressing these same challenges with predation and cleanliness and lawlessness, that they were able to actually become huge as an aggregate, right? A huge apparel producing hub within Central Asia that was reconstituted after the Soviet Union's collapse.
I see. So would you say that bazaar, I mean, order at the bazaar, as you have been describing it, existed specifically in this context, or that it still exists today?
That's a great question. So it definitely existed while I was doing field research and throughout the time of the 2010s. I haven't been able to travel to Bishkek in the last few years, sadly due to the global pandemic and due to other personal challenges. So I don't feel comfortable speaking to the exact day and moment. But I will say that I think that the bazaar, while it, for example, Dordoi, which has been presumed to be on the decline or dying many times throughout the past 20 to 30 years, whether it's because of a financial crisis or because of border closings with neighboring countries, and these are things that the traders cannot control, right? This is an uncertainty and a certain external shock that is extremely challenging for the traders and that has caused and led to bankruptcy and dramatic crisis for many of the traders. Despite all of that, the bazaar does still continue in the midst of a global pandemic and now increasing changes and challenges related to what's happening in Russia and with the war in Ukraine. And so I think that I'm excited that there are other scholars and people in the region that are continuing to pursue research on this bazaar, for example, in comparison with other large bazaars, for example, in Georgia, or other bazaars like the Baraholka I mentioned in Kazakhstan, and looking at them much more as I dare say an institution. I mean, I don't like to use that word, but as a fixture of post-Soviet Central Asian life and economy and society. So I think that how we see changes, for example, in those external contexts, as well as changes with the increasingly pious nature of society and the role of Islam, for example, those are all really exciting directions that I know people are working on now.
Thanks a lot. I think that is a great opening to the end of our conversation. I would really like to thank you to have accepted my invitation to speak with us today. And maybe just to give our listeners a glimpse of what is next, what are your nearest plans? Do you have any?
Yes, absolutely. Well, I'll just say one more word about some of the work that I did with Aysel Khanbatoyev, if that's okay, on this apparel sector, because I think it speaks to some of these questions about creativity and order. I think that when we were in Bishkek, actually at the same time, working on our own respective projects, and for this, I would really recommend the listeners to look at her work on the Islamic economy, for example, and the visions and futures that are being articulated with Islamic finance and halal commodities, and as well as others, right, who are thinking a lot about the changing nature of religion and society. We were very taken by this apparel sector. And so we co-authored a number of articles on what it meant for people who were very highly trained and skilled, for example, during the Soviet period in crafts, artisans, craft producers, to become leaders in regional and global fashion. In particular, this individual ne poshiv, where many women in particular became apparel producers for everyone from symphonies and local dance troupes to foreign consumers to local citizens with toys and weddings and celebrations. And they derived great pride from their work and translating Kyrgyz culture specifically and design and patchwork into fashion and reconstituted their livelihoods in this way. We also sought to understand how these dead buildings that, you know, looked as if they were not working and dilapidated from the outside were actually home to electricity and booming apparel sector, small shops, and how they reconstituted their trade networks, for example, how they used the trade with Kazakhstan and Russia to, and those networks and the cargo companies and the systems that were created and crafted during the periods of the 1990s and 2000s to now export and be intermediaries for the clothing that they would produce and re-export to Kazakhstan and Russia. And we also looked at them. I also looked at the labor and the changing patterns of movements of people that, again, initially traded maybe based at Dorzhdoy to their relatives or to networks in bazaars and other countries throughout the region, but used those networks and connections to better understand what types of goods people in Russia wanted, for example, or Kazakhstan, and make clothing that spoke to the needs of those populations, whether it was very particular styles of blouses or very particular patterns and fabrics that craftspeople and designers in Kyrgyzstan had a better sense of than the producers in more distant China, for example. And so those were all exciting ways that both of us, Aysel Khan and I, merged our interests in entrepreneurship and business in the region to better understand new dynamic sectors and industries. And I haven't spoken to all the challenges but of that sector. But I think that gives a sense of some of the work we've done. And right now I'm continuing to follow what's happening in the region in the midst of dramatic changes, whether it's COVID or what's been happening in the recent years. And I've also taken the time and the space in the midst of the pandemic to focus on what I believe to be an increasingly urgent global challenge that we face, but we have particular responsibility here in the United States and the West, which is to really reduce our carbon emissions and change the way we think about using energy. And I've become involved with some local organizations and some research to try to make my own space and my own place more livable and to responsibly transition ourselves away from fossil fuels, which, as we're seeing, has implications far away, whether it's rising sea levels to melting glaciers in Central Asia. And I'm combining or in parallel with this existing work on Central Asia, trying to play a much more local role in changing how we think about and use energy.
Well, yeah, kind of trying to make some order, I would say, around you.
Yes. I hadn't really thought about it that way, but yes, trying to create a new order in the way we think about and use energy, but that I think will have important regional and global implications if we can make the changes we need to make in time.
Well, thanks a lot. That's really exciting. I really enjoyed speaking with you. And for our listeners, if you wish to read or buy Regin books, you can find it on Cornell University Press online. And well, yeah, thanks a lot, everyone, and see you next time.